My name's Cody Rourke. I'm originally from Gladwin, Michigan. I was raised in the Church of the Brethren. I've been working in Israel-Palestine since 2005, so about 10 years. I'm also the father of an Israeli Jew. My son is 3 years old. His mother is Ephrat Helper, the daughter of Jeff Helper. So some of you may know Jeff Helper, some of you may not. Jeff Helper is an Israeli Jew who in 2007 was a finalist for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work with Inside the Conflict, specifically rebuilding homes for Palestinians that were demolished as a result of the war. The reason why I bring up some of these family dynamics is that, you know, some people ask, you know, what is it like, you know, to be a father and, you know, and raise, you know, raise an Israeli Jew, but also be working, you know, with Inside the West Bank, working with Palestinians. So I have a lot of family support. Ephrat was a conscientious objector. She refused to join the Israeli military, and so did both of her brothers. Her brother Yair actually served 6 months in Israeli jail for refusing to serve. And this is Yusuf, who's been working with CPT for the last couple of years. He's from Hebron, but as we move through the presentation, Yusuf will talk about his life and his experience growing up and also explain some of the dynamics in Hebron. So just real quick about the Christian Peacemaker Teams as an organization. So the Christian Peacemaker Teams are obviously, you know, in Palestine, but we also have other projects. We work in Iraqi Kurdistan. We work in Canada with the indigenous people. We also work in Colombia. But we also do a lot of stuff, you know, across America, whether it's Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ rights, water rights. We're doing things in Detroit. Anything that involves, you know, peace and justice, CPT tries to be in some capacity, because, you know, how we understand oppression and violence is that violence is rooted in oppression. And that's, you know, racism, sexism, you know, any sort of ism that, you know, pushes people down and doesn't allow them to be, you know, their full selves. One of the other distinctions about CPT is that, unlike a lot of other organizations, CPT only goes where they're invited to. Because a lot of the conflict that we see wrapped up in the world, you know, it's rooted in colonialism. And so, you know, the idea of it is that we don't want to be another organization that shows up and tells the indigenous people, you know, this is how we're going to make peace. So how CPT came to Palestine was after Barak Goldstein. So Barak Goldstein, the massacre in 1994 in which 37 Jews were killed, the mayor of Hebron had actually invited CPT to be, you know, an organization that observes and documents the human rights abuses.
Muslims.
Oh, right. I misspoke myself. Thanks for clarifying that. Yes, thank you. So Barak Goldstein was actually a physician from New York. He was one of the settlers that came into Hebron to colonize the area and participate in expanding the Israeli settlements inside of the West Bank. Okay. So I'm just going to click back a few years. That's how CPT was introduced to take part in the project in Palestine. And so when we look across history, you know, this area of land here, whether we call it Palestine, whether we call it Israel, whether we call it the land of milk and honey, whatever we want to call it, the reality of it is that for hundreds of years, you know, Jews and Christians and Muslims and Samaritans, you know, all lived in relative peace in this area, okay? You know, the conflict kind of evolves as you see the Palestinian green area kind of being ate up by the white area, which is, you know, the area in which Israel, the government of Israel, has kind of captured and colonized for itself. When we take a look at the conflict, it's important to look at how this land is being gobbled up and at the same time chase that trajectory, you know, over the intifadas, the second intifada, what we're experiencing now, okay? So that's really important to note. So, you know, it kind of begs the question of how this springs up, right? In 1936, there was an Arab revolt inside of Hebron in which 67 Palestinian Jews were killed during this period of time. And so, you know, one of the questions that, you know, that people oftentimes don't ask, why was it the case that, you know, Palestinian Muslims and Palestinian Jews had lived for centuries in harmony, you know, inside of Hebron? And how does this escalation all of a sudden happen where 67 people were killed, okay? On the flip side of that, you know, when you look at that, you know, there was over 400, you know, Palestinian Jews that were saved during that massacre, and they were helped to, you know, get out of Hebron and resettle in Jerusalem. And that's an important point to note.
Who saved them?
The Muslim Palestinians inside of Hebron. And so when you look at that, you know, what you had is you had a yeshiva, you know, a Jewish school inside of Hebron. And what happened was, is, you know, there was a string of Judaism, which is called Zionism, okay? And it's the idea of creating, there's a string of Zionism which says, you know, we'll create a state of Israel and we'll reclaim this land. And, you know, different people, you know, describe Israel in a different space as others. So you had these Zionist students that came in to Hebron, you know, that weren't a part of the local community, and they disrupted the fabric of life. And at the same time, the Palestinians are recognizing that with the backing of the British government, that the Israeli Jews are able to manipulate different land laws under the Ottoman Empire to literally, you know, take land away from Palestinians to have these development projects all across Israel-Palestine. So when you had these young yeshiva students come into site of Hebron, that's what sparked the conflict during that 1936 revolt. And so what you have is when you look across these different flare-ups inside of the military occupation, what it is, you know, it's periods of time in which Israeli settlers are, you know, creating unrest between, you know, the Palestinians. So when you look at this, especially this recent period of time, there's been lots of settlement expansion. There's been murder of Palestinians. What was the Palestinian family that was murdered? The baby was caught on fire. The Dawabshi family. You know, there was no recourse for that. You know, you have these Israeli Jews that set this Palestinian home on fire. You know, and the mother died and the child died. And although the Israeli military knows, you know, who the murderer was, they refused to bring any justice. And the father died as well. So I don't want to get too much into all of those dynamics, because I think it's more important that, you know, that you hear from, you know, you hear from Yusuf and hear from a Palestinian who's, you know, grew up inside of Hebron, you know, what those dynamics are like. Yeah. So what is the difference between an Israeli Jew and a Palestinian Jew? So the idea of it is that before 1948, this area of land was referred to Palestine, right? So, you know, the Jews that would have been living in this area, they wouldn't have referred to themselves as Israeli Jews because the state did not exist. It was still Palestine.
Thank you for being here. My name is Yusuf Meche, from Palestine, West Bank, Hebron, from an area that's called Itzron. And Itzron did come, or the name of it did come for sure by an agreement. Some people say that it is the new city of Hebron. And I can say it's not that so different from the old city of Hebron. Just the names is different. When I did come to here, to Chicago, I have been thinking which story that I can tell for people to see how the Palestinians will grow up under occupation. But I realized that it is hard to tell all the stories since I did start realizing that there is occupation on my land. So I start saying in my mind, from where I can start? When I was 9 years old, when I go to the Ibrahim Mosque, and an Israeli soldier show up and stop me and made body surge and pointing his gun at me? Or do I have to start when the Israeli army came to my father's house and they thought that it was my neighbor's house, that they were planning to demolish it, and they were planning to demolish my father's house? Or do I have to say the story of me being in a school and my school surrounded by military jeeps and they take us out of the school for them to put their jeeps and their machines around the school? But I said in my mind, I will tell a story that can maybe explain a little bit how the occupation looks like. So I will ask a question. You are right now in America, and if American soldier or a policeman stopped you and he will ask for an ID, how many IDs do you need to show it for the police to know who you are?
One.
Yeah, so it depends on if you are white or black or indigenous. Yeah. So that's right. But also, if you are crossing a border, for example, if you are crossing a border going to another country, do you need more than one?
Yeah,
you do not need anything. Yeah, so if he wants to arrest you, he has to have a good reason. But the story behind this question is to show you, a Palestinian, how many IDs that he has to show it for a soldier, an Israeli soldier, if he did stop him. And if he needs to cross a border, which it's called checkpoint, a military checkpoint, how many IDs he has to show. And if he have to go to cross the wall to reach Jerusalem, how many IDs he have to show? And if he's actually going to another country, if he is lucky, how many IDs he have to show? So what I have here is how many IDs that I have. The first ID that I did had it when I was 16 years old. It is the West Bank ID, and it is green. And also the color of the ID, you know, there is a goal behind it. So this is the green ID that Palestinians that they are living in West Bank, they have to have it. And I thought when I get it, when I was in the school, when I was 16 years old, you know, you'll be having the feeling of, you know, having ID and, you know, start to realize that you start to be adult and you will be happy and to have it around. But I realized that actually I have to have it around all the time with me, because if an Israeli soldier stopped me, I have to have this ID. Or he will be, detained me for hours until he will release me, or maybe he will arrest me because I'm not having this ID. So this ID is written in Arabic and Hebrew that the Israeli soldier, he can read it. And for sure, another Palestinian, for example, Palestinian that they are living in Jerusalem, they having different color of the ID. So this is the first ID that I have it. And then I start working in a radio station, and I realize that I'm holding a camera on the ground, and an Israeli soldier stopped me, and he said, "Do you have a card or permission to film? Because you have to show me that you are actually a journalist to film a military." So I realized then that I have to have an ID to show them that I'm a journalist. And to be honest with you, it's not helpful all the time. Because simply, an Israeli soldier, he can push a journalist back from a document, an incident that did happen, whatever, in West Bank or in Jerusalem. Lately, right now, a lot of human rights violation against the media in Palestine, specifically right now, the situation is complicated even to explain, but right now even they use rubber bullets, live ammunition, tear gas, sound bombs to move that journalist who's having the camera to document what the military do. So until now, two IDs. And then for me to cross the wall to go to Jerusalem, or at least to go to the American consulate in Jerusalem, they asked me to do an Israeli ID. And this an Israeli ID, it does not mean that you are an Israeli citizen. It's just because they want me to have it, so they will be having my data, my name, my address, my ID number, my location on the system, my fingerprint. All that will be when I just apply for this ID to have it. And they cannot give me the paper permission, which they call it permit, to go in Jerusalem to Jerusalem if I'm not having this ID. So I have to have it. And it does not give me the permission to go to Jerusalem. But I have to have it to have the permit to go to Jerusalem. So I can say for you that it is useless anyway, but I have to pay money for it to have it. And also I have to have it so I can have a permit to go to Jerusalem. And the permit is, I can say it is another ID anyway. The permit to have it to go to Jerusalem is another ID for a Palestinian that you have to show it for the soldier to give you the access, if he wants, to Jerusalem, specifically from the wall to Jerusalem. And then I start working with CBT, and they will start, you know, they stopped me once and they said, how we can know that you are a CBTer and peacemaker? You are Palestinian, how that's come? So it will not be enough for them to see the hat and the uniform for CBT. They will not believe a Palestinian, he's having a green ID. He's a peacemaker. So I also having two IDs for CBT. And when I did cross the border to be in Jordan, because I'm not allowed to use Ben Gurion Airport for sure, when I did cross the border, I reached Jordan border. And for sure, from before, I have been crossing the Palestinian border, the Israeli border, and then the Jordanian border. And they said for me, where is your green card? And I said, what is that? And they said, it is a card that if you are living in West Bank, that you have to have it. So I have also this card that I should to have it when I go crossing the Jordanian border to be in Jordan in general. And then, I don't know what I can call this, but they call it passport. It is written on it, the Palestinian Authority. And lately, the Palestinian Authority tried to make a passport written on it, the Palestinian State. But actually, the Israeli Authority refused that. So we having this passport that it's just only written in Arabic and English, that we will have it to move around also to cross the border, the actual border, to go to move to another country. And yeah, as any passport, you have to have it. So I have all of these. I don't know if someone having this bunch of ideas. Okay, so as my teammate said, CBT have been in Hebron since 1995 after the massacre that did happen in the Ibrahim Mosque by Baruch Goldstein when he killed 29 Muslims in the early morning when they were praying by a machine gun when he did enter the Ibrahim Mosque. A lot of stories behind that a story, different stories, or actually a lot of people told the story for me, survivors, that they did survive from that massacre that did happen at the Ibrahim Mosque. And then Palestinians start to have issue to access Shuhada Street, which is one of the main streets in Hebron. But a small explanation here to explain what the difference between H2 area and H1 area, that by the agreement, H2 area is under the Israeli authority control, and H1 is under the Palestinian authority control, which that does not mean that the Israeli military cannot actually access or be in H1 area. They can be in H1 area. They can demolish houses, the Palestinians' houses. They can arrest the Palestinians. They have been actually shooting Palestinians and kidnapping them. There is actually the opposite of it, that the Palestinian authority cannot be in H2 area, which the Palestinians that they are living in H2 area, they have the civilians' service from the Palestinian authority. So H2 area, which it is 18% of Hebron, under the Israeli control. The red lines here is the streets that the Palestinians cannot walk inside them by a military decision, and they will call it for security reasons. Shuhada Street should be open by the Israeli High Court. It should be open, but the point is that if the Israeli High Court take a decision, they have to go back to the military and take their opinion about it. And if the military said no, because it is no, because they can, so it can be stay closed or locked or blocked. The another map here, it's showing that the streets that the Palestinians not allowed to drive inside them. And I can say that this area having one checkpoint here, another checkpoint here, third checkpoint here, and inside the old city here, there is a checkpoint here, and a lot of enclosures. So even to enter with your car, you need a permission. Specifically, this area here beside Kiryat Arba settlement, you need to have a permit to access this street, which they call it a prayer road street. You have to have a permit to access that military checkpoint down here. The Palestinians from before, they were not allowed at all to drive here, but right now they have in permissions, 300 permission so far for the Palestinians that they are living in this area here between two settlements, Kiryat Arba settlement and Givat Havot settlement. This map is showing how many settlements inside the old city, which that's a different. So when we said a settlements in West Bank in general, you will imagine big lands, and in middle of them, huge buildings, different buildings, and surrounded by a wall, and that area will be having a gate, and we can say bunch of sitters, they are living inside, like 4,000 or 8,000 sitters that they are living inside. But the difference here in H2 area, in the old city of Hebron, that the settlements is building, or two buildings, and they build these buildings on top of the Palestinian shops and around the Palestinian houses. So that's the difference. We have in the old city of Hebron four settlements, and I can naming them. So the first settlement is Tel Hermeda settlement, which they give the settlement the name of the Palestinian neighborhood, Tel Hermeda. And the settlement in middle of Tel Hermeda, and they give it the name of Tel Hermeda anyway. It is two buildings, and I can say they are big buildings. Lately, they occupied large land around that settlement, and they said that they are looking for history. So for them to find that history, they use bulldozers to cut all the olive trees from that land and make it completely white land for them to find the history that they are looking for it. So they use bulldozers and history to find it, specifically, you know, connected with the stones, old stones, That means that you already destroyed them using bulldozers. Beit Hadassah settlement, it is also in the middle of the old city and surrounded by a bunch of Palestinians' family, and also on top of the Palestinians' job. I will show a picture for it. And then Beit Romano settlement, that it was a school under UN from before. And then Abraham Avinu settlement, which also in the middle of the old city. And this one is the Palestinians there. They had the street that they used it to access to the Ibrahimi Mosque, and a lot of harassments happened there in front of the Israeli military either. Settlers throwing stones and water to the street down. The Palestinians, they will be opening their shops, and they will be suffering from the settlers' harassment from the roof. CBT did witness, actually, even soldiers with the settlers throwing stones down to that street to the Palestinians, and the soldiers, they wouldn't do anything. So these are the names of the four settlements. The bigger settlement, which they say that it is outside of H2 area, but actually I can say it has started to be inside H2 area by the steps or the stairs, the road they used it to access to the synagogue, which is part of the Ibrahimi Mosque. It is Kiryat Arba settlement. It is one of the biggest settlements in the area here. And I can say from 7,000 to 8,000 settlers that they are living in that area. Right now, I will just explain how CBT works on the ground. The first thing is the education. We are standing on two military checkpoints in the morning at 7 until 8 a.m. and from 12 to 1 p.m. to make sure that the students, they have the access to their schools and to their houses. This is the picture of a military checkpoint. Two Israeli border police standing on that checkpoint, which I cannot understand why they're having border police on that checkpoint, because it's not a border anyway. As you see here, Palestinians' kids standing by the checkpoint, and two Palestinian students, they take their jackets off and their bags between the Israeli border police hands, and the Israeli border police searching these bags and also making body search for these young students, Palestinian students. So anyone to access to the Ibrahimi Mosque area and the old city, they have to cross this military checkpoint. And another one is just only far, another like 2 minute to 3 minute walking from this area. This border police here, he has been involved with arresting two Palestinian boys 10 years old, even the against their law, because the military law saying that the Palestinians from the Israeli military law saying that the Palestinians from 12 and up, they are adult, and from 12 and down, they are children. So even they did actually broke that law, and they did arrest two Palestinian boys 10 years old. What I will show right now, a video that CBT did document the story from the beginning until the end, showing how the father of one of the children and the mother have been trying to release the children from a bunch of military, Israeli military, to not make them taking these boys to the Israeli military station.
Leave my son, this little boy. This is the mother, you know, crying, asking for her to have her sons. See how scared the children are. They need a doctor now. As the Israeli soldier grabs the two young boys by their neck collars. They're shaking, they're scared. The father argues, "What about the law? These are children." The soldier said, "The boys threw stones here. Wait here." The mother is pleading, see the children? They have nothing on their hands. The boys are talking to the soldier and explaining that they were only going to the school. and then they stopped at the supermarket, and that they were far from the soldiers. We tried to tell the Israeli soldiers that we were just going to the store to buy something. The mother's pointing out to the soldiers, look at how scared they are. The mother's explaining that, you know, there's been young boys that's died in the prisons, of the Israeli prisons, and that's why she doesn't want them to go. The mother reminds the Israeli soldiers that they talk about Israel being a democracy, but then tells the soldiers that they're not a democracy, that it's an apartheid state. The Palestinian father continues to argue with the Israeli military. He says, I want my children. But the sergeant of the border police says, no, you can't have them. The father reminds the Israeli sergeant that these are just young boys, that they're not old enough to be taken to jail under Israeli law. But regardless of pointing the laws out, the Israeli border police still take the young children. The Palestinian father pleads for the Israeli border police to show them the security camera, to show him the evidence of the two young boys throwing stones. The young boys explain that they did not throw stones, that they were just going to the supermarket, with tears rolling down their eyes. The father is upset and scared that his sons are going to be taken away, and he screams at the soldier, just shoot me in the head. An Israeli military officer grabs the kids by the back of the necks and pulls them down the street as the kids get pushed into the security van. They're screaming for their mother, scared and crying. They're yelling for their mother. Finally, the Israeli police allow the mother to go to the police station with the children. The father wants space and is feeling dizzy and sick. People from the community try to support him, but the Israeli soldiers continue to talk to him and be around him. The father, he has to lay on the ground after watching his children be taken away from him.
So this is one of the stories that we did witness. And as I usually say that, not all the time we can witness all the things that's happening on the ground. There is a lot of stories that the Palestinians, they were told us about it when we go on the ground to make our patrols. And they were told us that the Israeli soldiers have been arresting someone, or they have been detained someone, or they have been entering that Palestinian house. Another checkpoint here, it is called 29 checkpoint. As you see here, a Palestinian girl standing beside one of the CBTers and a soldier, he is have been going out of the checkpoint to go down, and there is a bunch of schools down. These two checkpoints here, surrounded by 7 schools, 2 kindergarten, and 1 health center, that they get a lot harassed by the tear gas, the sand bombs, the rubber bullets that the Israeli military used it on these two checkpoints. The schools a lot have been closed by the tear gas. The tear gas is not actually, they're not actually just shooting the tear gas on the street. Sometimes they shoot the tear gas and target the schools. They shoot the tear gas and pointing the guns to the Palestinians' house. They have been, one of the Palestinians' house have been burned by a tear gas, entered the house from the window, and all the house got burned from that tear gas. What we usually do in these two check points is counting the Palestinians' kids and make our reports and send our reports for the organizations that they do care about the human rights evaluation, specifically against the education in Hebron. What we also do is to help a Palestinian's children to go to their kindergarten. The principal of that kindergarten asked us to be there to help these children to reach the kindergarten and them reaching their house back in a safe way. They have been harassed by the Israeli border police on the two checkpoints that they have to cross it to reach the kindergarten or to reach their houses. Me and my teammate Cody, the Israeli military, have been arresting us for just walking with these kids for 10 hours. And they have been charging us that we have been harassing the border police, that we have been dangerous for the Israeli civilians, and we didn't do what the border police asked us to do. This is how it looks like in another checkpoint in its two area. And the Israeli border police will be standing on the checkpoint and ask the children to come to him. And the Israeli border police, he will take or grab the bag and start open it and search the bag. Some police, they will be stopped for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or a half an hour or even an hour, and they will be late for their school for sure. Mosque patrol, it is one of also our duty in on the ground. We will stand and making sure that each Friday the Palestinians having the access to the Ibrahim Mosque. The Ibrahim Mosque, to have the access to the Ibrahim Mosque, you have to cross two checkpoints. This boy here who is standing to the fence, the Israeli border police grabbed his bicycle when he tried to have the access to the checkpoint. The border police took his bicycle, and these boys, they were waiting to take the bicycle back. This is how the military checkpoint looks like when you try to access the Ibrahim Mosque to pray. The Palestinians, they will put all their phones, money, things that this machine will be annoyed from. And if the Israeli border police allow them to enter, they will open the another gate in front of them. Another thing that CBT also do, each Friday in the night, we will be in the Briar Road, the one that I showed on the map beside Kiryat Arba settlement, and making sure that the Palestinians there, specifically that there is a lot of Palestinians family there, that they are safe. In effect, that the settlers, they will go down from the settlement and go down to the synagogue to pray. But how they go down to the prayer, not all of them, but at least how you can see, that they'll be having machine guns and walking on the prayer road between the Palestinians' kids that they are playing in the street. So the picture is two Palestinians, boys, walking on the same street that a settler having a machine gun to go down to the synagogue to pray. What we do is document that and come to here to talk about it and show you the fact of an Israeli settler, a civilian, who is having a machine gun to go down to the synagogue to pray. Another thing that we actually do also on the ground every Saturday since 2009, there is a settler tour that did happen each Saturday at 5 p.m. or 4 p.m. This will take an hour around the Palestinians' houses and shops. Bunch of settlers, they will be inside that tour, and they will be surrounded by a bunch of military, as you see in this picture. All these soldiers, they were surrounding 25 settlers, maybe 30, maximum 100, specifically in one of the big holidays that they have at Sabra holiday. They will be going down to the old city The Israeli army, they will go up to the Palestinians' house's roof. This is one of the pictures of two Israeli soldiers. They have been on the Palestinian home roof. The Palestinian girl standing on the back on a corner when she was mapping the steps when the Israeli soldiers decided to go down. Also, big part of our work is responding for emergencies. As you see here in the picture, a Palestinian boy that the Israeli border police put him on the ground and waiting another soldier to open the gate so they can take him to the military area. They have been actually three times arresting this boy during that week. Another picture for responding for emergencies, and it is showing that the mother in the middle and a Palestinian boy, her son, behind her, and a bunch of military, Israeli military, surrounded them. The mother this time succeeded to release her son from the boys, but they arrested him the next day. We're not just only responding for the emergencies during the day, we're also responding for emergencies during the night. This is a picture for a Palestinian family that the Israeli army have been entering their house at 2 a.m. in the morning. We were making patrol that day, and we find out a bunch of military that they have been inside the house. They did not allow us to enter the house for sure. And when they went out of the house, we entered the house, we find out that they have been destroying everything inside the house. And this picture, we have been taken at 3 a.m. until the military goes out of the house. Another picture here is showing one of the pictures that we did take it here is a bunch of settlers in the back, the Israeli army in the front and in the back in the middle also. And in this picture, the settlers, they want to go out of H1 area, which the H1 area, as we said, under the Palestinian Authority, for them to go to pray in a cave. They call it Hebron Cave. So this is specific in specific holidays. They will go out and block a Palestinian street for 7 hours almost to have the access to pray there. The Palestinians, they will close their shops. They will not be allowed to reach their houses also. A settler here tried to go out of the fence that the Israeli military put it there, and it is a closed military zone anyway to the left from where is the settlers goes out. I did take that picture when the settler boy tried to go out of the fence to the Palestinian neighborhood. A picture here also for also a boy. He get actually harassed by the Israeli military when he was just only piking behind the six soldiers that they were making patrol in the old city. CBT participating in nonviolent demonstrations against the occupation here. It is one of the pictures that we have been taken during a demonstration, nonviolent demonstration against the British mandate that the Israeli law used it to arrest Palestinians without a reason and use the security file, like to name the file as a, what they call it, security, like not security. No one have to see that file. Even the lawyer of the Palestinian that he has been in the Israeli jail, his lawyer, he cannot see that file. And the Palestinians, they will be in a jail for a month or for a year or even longer. Participating also with meetings with the locals to give them more information about what's actually have been witnessing, and also with different human rights organizations to take a step and try to change what's going on, specifically against education. Participating in in peace activists for children. We will be helping the kids to ask them what is your dream, what is your hopes, and this is one of the kids that has been saying that, drawing that on a paper, saying that peace in English, salam in Arabic, and he's have been writing his in Arabic here on this side, saying that salam is one of the things that nations needed to live. And all the time we are saying that we're having hope for a better tomorrow as Palestinians, and all of the time we're having hope for a better tomorrow. Thank you all for listening, and we will open for questions. So the number usually is from 6 to 7 people, sometimes is more, and sometimes also less than 6 people, because the fact of getting deported from the country or different reasons of, for example, our work will be focused more during the school time rather than the summer time. And right now we are 3 on the ground. Week ago, a teammate of mine get arrested and denied her from Hebron for 15 days because she did post a picture on Instagram and they were looking for her, and they said she should not post that picture. And after 15 days, she did come back to Hebron.
The video was talking about how idea of mapping all of the Palestinian population from babies all the way to all of them. Can you share anything you know about why they're doing this?
Why they can do that? Because they can, and they having the power. Different reasons sometimes for the Israeli military to enter a Palestinian house in the middle of the night and searching all the house, collecting the family and put them in one room. It can happen for just the military, they want to do that. A lot of patrols did happen in the night. We can say that the Israeli soldiers, they will enter the house in the middle of the night. I don't know if my teammate having a different answer for that.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a variety of different reasons. One of the reasons that breaking the silence, which is the Israeli military officers that have served in the occupation and now are trying to, like, you know, explain the occupation in depth. One of the things that they like to say is that you have to rule by fear, okay? You know, you keep families on edge. You know, create the illusion that the Israeli military can strike at any time and anywhere. So by going into the homes, right, at will, at any time, it keeps people paranoid and it keeps them, you know, separated. One great example of this method of keeping people, you know, fearful and keeping the society fragmented is, you know, one of the soldiers told this story of going out to this Palestinian village. They had to do a patrol. So what they said is that we want one person in the village who's not political, who doesn't belong to Hamas, who doesn't belong to Fatah, just an average farmer that no one would suspect of being a collaborator. So what they did is they went into the village, they took this Palestinian man, but they made sure that the whole village was watching them grab this Palestinian man and put him in the jeep. And what they did was they just took the Palestinian man out and they drove him around for a couple of hours. And then they dropped him off. And when they let the Palestinian man out of the jeep, you know, they patted him on the back and shook his hand and said all this stuff and made sure that all of the people were kind of watching, right? So now the people in the village have to wonder, you know, what did this man share with the military, right? And even though he didn't say anything, you know, if you're living inside of a community, you know, where there's been a lot of decisiveness between people, right? What does that do and what does that show? So that's one example. Other examples are is they want to know what political parties are affiliated with, what families are involved in there, right? So a lot of it has to do with fear, gathering evidence, you know. Some of the things that Yusuf talked about was we show up to the military checkpoints, and when the children are passing through, we make sure that we document that and what that looks like. So, you know, are there instances in which Palestinian men are being arrested during that period of time? Up until now, there's been approximately 1,000 tear gas canisters shot off in Hebron, 80% of which has happened at these military checkpoints that the kids walk through. That's approximately 800 tear gas canisters. So what was your name again?
Stephen.
So Stephen had just said that he watched a video that wasn't a part of the traditional U.S. Media outlets, okay? So one of the things that the CPT team does is that we record and we document this so the truth can come out, right? There's that educational component. But there's also the component of protective presence. And the way in that there are instances, based on racial dynamics, that if you have a younger white person or an older white person from America, from Australia, from Canada, one of the privileged countries, they show up, it can be the case that an Israeli soldier will not necessarily attack a Palestinian or arrest a Palestinian right then and there. That's one of the risks that we take. So earlier this past year, Yusuf and I was escorting 5 young kindergarten kids to school, and we were arrested for no other reason other than that we were walking with the young kids to school. And as a result of that, what Yusuf risked was Yusuf could have been put in jail indefinitely without giving any reason why. And I myself could have been deported and also lost access to being a father, right? Because my son lives in Jerusalem.
And I will just say a small thing about also what CPT can do, specifically for children. We directly take the information from the parents and call the Palestinian police, because they can call the Israeli police station, follow up how they can release the boy and how they can take it back and send it back to their family, which that's what happened with the 10-year-old boys that they get arrested. Another thing that once we start filming as an adult have been stopped by the Israeli soldiers, and they charged him that he has been hitting the soldier. But what we did film is the soldier did hit the Palestinian. And in the court, the Palestinian family asked us to send that video that we did film to the lawyer so he can use it in the court. And that's what happened, and they released him in a week.
Yeah, so, it depends if you're Palestinian or if you're an international. So obviously, for Palestinians...
Are you a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, so I'm a U.S. citizen.
And you're a Palestinian citizen. Okay.
Right, yeah. So, Yusuf is pretty much at the mercy of whatever, the military decides. As an American citizen, I still have, diplomatic, resources that I can exercise, right? We can get the lawyers involved, and raise a public awareness campaign. That at times does help. There's thousands of Palestinians right now, languishing in Israeli prisons. So the amount of resources that there are for legal help, there's just not enough to go around. Speaking of that, it's also the way in which the Israeli, legal system manipulates the law to further its agenda. So there was this young American activist. Her name was Rachel Corrie. And some of us have heard about Rachel Corrie. Rachel Corrie was a young activist who was killed by a bulldozer in Gaza, probably about, maybe 10 years ago. I forget how long it's been. So, we had followed the court case. That's one of the things that CPT does. We follow the court cases, the different movements, so we can then, in return, come back here and talk about things. So, the Israeli defense that was in charge of, representing the Israeli soldiers that had murdered her, okay? What they had said, what Rachel Corrie's legal unit was arguing, that international law should be applied to this court case, okay? And international law says that the military has an obligation to protect, the local population, okay? And what the Israeli defense argued in return was that international law in this case did not apply to Rachel Corrie because she wasn't a Palestinian. The international law says that they're only obligated to protect the local population. Right? Yeah. So they, I mean, this was a legal argument that was sustained in the highest court of Israel. I mean, this is a kangaroo court. It's whatever they decide to throw out there, and it's regardless of who's there. I mean, these are statements that are said inside of the court with with journalists, with other politicians in such a high-profile case. It's the audacity in which the Israeli government operates, right? I mean, we can even see this, you know, when Benjamin Netanyahu decided to come to Congress here a few months back.
Yeah.
The audacity of doing that to the president of the United States. I mean, even his, you know, the spokesman, the way in which he's talked about Barack Obama recently. I mean, Israel acts with impunity, and there's that culture of that within inside.
Where is Hebron located in the West Bank?
It's located approximately like 45 kilometers southeast of Jerusalem, so it's in the West Bank. This idea that, you know, that these wars and these conflicts are about Hamas, that's never the case, hardly ever the case. It's all about resources, okay? So when we see the conflict evolving the way that it is in Hebron, you know, it has to do with settlement expansion. Can we go back to these first maps here real quick? You have Kiryat Arba settlement, the Abraham Avinu settlement, the Beit Hadassah settlement, the Tel Aramea settlement, inside of Hebron, okay? You also have another settlement, the Al-Rajabi settlement, that was developed about 2 years ago. What Yusuf said at the beginning of this bit, that there was an excavation done here, okay? And so, you know, you also have settlement expansion here. So this new settlement here, if this gets developed, you're going to have this whole encirclement of Palestinians that live here, you know, completely walled off from the rest of, from the west of Hebron. Mm-hmm. There's also another settlement, where am I at here, Yusuf? Where's the map? Down here is called the Abu Rajab House. That's another settlement. So inside of Hebron right now, there's a large movement to develop, you know, these settlements, right? And so these excavations here, like what Yusuf said, is that they just came in with bulldozers. Okay, of course you're going to use some machinery to do, you know, archaeological work, but, you know, what you don't do is you don't come in with bulldozers and just clean the land off, right? Because if you're doing real archaeological work, right, They're scooping up layers of Ottoman Empire history. They're scooping up broken pots and plates. You know, so it's historical cleansing as well as ethnic cleansing. And Emanuel Eisenberg, who's the head of the Israeli Antiquities Authority, he stood right there to Yusuf and I, and he said that here there'll be a kiosk, that here there'll be a restaurant, that here there'll be apartments. There was plum trees and
old olive trees.
Yeah. And so when you do archaeological research, right, anybody who does research knows that you don't say that my research will end with X, right? You do research with the intent of trying to discover something. So in this way, you know, the Israeli Antiquities Authority said that we're going to develop a biblical museum here. So how do you know what the outcome of your research is going to be, right? And so it was obvious that, you know, if you already have development plans to build a museum, you're not setting yourself up to do real archaeological research. And so as a result of this paradigm of doing archaeological work, right, for development, you know, you see different archaeological societies across Europe, across Australia, across the United States that are boycotting, because this is a way in which even academics are used to perpetuate the confiscation of Palestinian land for the development of more Israeli buildings and economic resources?
Good question. So Christians, peacemaker team, CBT, is what they do is taking the information for the adult or for the boy who get arrested by the military, his name, his age, his number ID, if it is available, to send it for the organizations that they have the access to know where he is. These organizations, they cannot be on the ground sometime. So what we do is to do that step and help them to find where he is. The idea is also, when we are on the ground and witness that, we will witness that that adult or that child, they have been taking him to a military place. So even if we did send the information already to the Palestinian police or to the Palestinian civilian, they will try to contact the Israeli police to know where they are, why they did arrested them, and what will happen with them, to inform the family and informing us to make our reports. They will not finding them in the system because they have been arresting them and put them in a military place. They will not actually have the names and the information in the Israeli commuters system. And we have been witnessing that they will arresting them for 3 hours or 4 hours and putting them in that military area, and no one will be having information where they are. And they will release them from that area also. And that's happened. We did witness 16 years old and 15 years old, two Palestinians have been arrested by the Israeli military, and they put them in that military area beside one of the settlements. And I think from 3 p.m. until 9 p.m., we were trying to communicate with a lot of human rights organizations and Palestinian leaders to try to find where they are. And when they released them, we were having the family numbers, they were having our numbers. They called us when they reached the house walking that they have been in that military area.
Is Hebron unique in having Israeli settlements within the city limits? This is the first time I've actually heard about settlements within a mainly Palestinian town. Are there others? This is pretty insidious, actually.
Hebron is unique in that way in the West Bank, but there are, you know, settlements inside of East Jerusalem, as we're starting to see, that are getting built up in Palestinian neighborhoods like in Sheikh Jarrah and so on and so forth. You know, and right now, you know, a lot of the flare-up around Jerusalem has to do with those settlement expansions in Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem.
And I can say that also, that's the things that people, they think that in each Jew is the same story in different areas in West Bank. But the point is that this is the difference between naming the areas in West Bank in a different way and saying it is a new agreement and saying that it is the Hebron Protocol, and rather than to name the area as they usually name it, Area A, Area B, Area C, they said that Hebron having a specific agreement to say that it is Area 1 and Area 2, or Area H1 and Area H2. And the story of how the settlements designed in H2, it is hard to imagine that.
So I think we have time for one more question. It's already 9 o'clock.
What can we do?
You know, this gentleman here had hold up a sign, yeah, and it says, you know, Palestinian lives matter. You know, I think any time that we can remind people that just because they're not white-skinned Christians, you know, these are important people. I mean, we're all,
you know, children of God. And that's important. And to start to break this down. I saw that there was a sign out here, you know, driving up. Perfect. Perfect. Black Lives Matter. Right? And that's important. And that's important. Because when we look across any sort of success stories, you know, recently, it's that, you know, the Black Lives Matter folk have worked with the Palestinian affinity groups to make these BDS resolutions possible. What you saw during the Ferguson affair was that Palestinians were actually sending tweets to the people in Ferguson, yeah, about how to handle and deal with tear gas. So what's happening here is that people are starting to recognize they're all intertwined with each other. And so now what we're seeing is we're seeing Palestinian activists that are going to these Black Lives Matter actions across Chicago, across New York, across California, because they recognize at the heart of this and at the heart of this conflict, I would even argue that what we have to deal with as communities is the racial component. Because when we look at some of the killings here specifically in Israel, resources don't explain why a white Jew would kill a dark Jew. I mean, we have instances in which, you know, Ethiopian Jews are being killed, Arab Jews are being killed. And so how do you make that distinction? That's based on skin color. So resources can't explain that. But racism within side of Israel does. That's how you demonize the other, is by saying, you know, what is different? And it's the color of their skin. We've had 6 CPTers in the last 3 years denied entry into the country. Because what Israel does not want is for these stories to come out. Because these stories demonstrate that Israel is not this liberal democracy that it plays itself out to be. And most importantly, it demonstrates that Israel is not the victim, right? Israel, in order to continue this military occupation, from a propaganda standpoint, has to maintain the image of the victim. It has to perpetuate and recreate this image. You know, it's hard when you're not able to build human capital within sight of the Palestine group, right? We just had another CPTer, a fantastic CPTer, that was denied entry just 2 weeks ago. She spoke Arabic. You know, she knows how to write reports. She knows how to navigate the area. You know, and now what do? We have to bring someone else brand new in and train them. So with inside of that, a lot of times, you know, CPT is just focused on being on the ground, being in solidarity with the Palestinians, documenting, cataloging that, taking that pool of data, putting it out. When we can, come back here to America and share these stories. That's one small thing that we can do.